poet Rodney Jones was raised in rural Alabama before traipsing off to study in North Carolina on his way to becoming a now emeritus professor of Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. He's since settled in New Orleans, but has not retired from turning a phrase.
I like zingers, and I hate it when something I think of as a defining last line occurs to me in the middle of the poem. Something like, the sweeter the pie, the shorter the prayer. I knew I had to fit it in.
Discover how Rodney Jones worked this line into his Kingsley Tufts prize-winning book of 100 selected poems, Salvation Blues. We'll also hear from his newer book, Imaginary Logic, and what he's learned from literary friends. Today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I caught him at Rockhurst University's 2016 Midwest Poet Series. Here's Rodney Jones with his poem, The Obsolescence of Thou.
Last heard in a country church, in a prayer that an elderly spinster had decked out in what manner she thought befitting for heaven's immoderate ears, it seemed all a Sunday rite and benediction, except some grave care in its blurting out made me think of the papa she had tended, and kisses foregone for her all-mending hands-on balm and alertness to afflictions just surrendered to the cemetery. But also the way her prayers always ended, have thine own sweet way, sweet Lord, have thine own sweet way. Broaden the context, so I'd attach it to pound wooing Keats. Thine arms are as a young sapling under the bark. And love that did get made, often sweetly, but how soon antiqued and caricatured. Not that I'd managed it yet myself, just that it seemed prudent to have some sense to repent, and that one in particular.
That's The Obsolescence of Thou from the collection Elegy for the Southern Drawl, and included in the award-winning selected poems of Rodney Jones called Salvation Blues. You're taking this bit of antiquated language and looking at how it fits into the culture. You sprinkle that throughout your work.
I think I hit that early as an interest in the idiom, and I always liked words, but there's more than words, of course, and I think poets tend to sometimes make too much of a word as opposed to who's carrying the word or who's living in the word. I always thought every word bore the track of everyone who had ever spoken it.
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
And I always thought the dirty words were low-class words, and the Latin and French words were okay to say, no matter the organ that was being spoken of. You know, as I was reading that, I was a little embarrassed because I felt like it was a very schoolmarmish syntax that I'd strung that on.
Oh, interesting. As a poet, do you find an urge to go back and mess with your poetry?
You know, I mess with it so much that at some point I don't. But often I regret having done what I did to it, and I see other possibilities that may seem more human, more naked, more in line with a natural behavior. I think language is a behavior, and that's what I'm interested in, is creating a believable human behavior in language. And the shaped literary language I love as much as the other registers. There's so much great fiction. Lately I've been reading Hilary Mantel, and she's just such a carver. It's a great thing, language.
It is a great thing. This particular book, Salvation Blues, came out in 2007, and it's pulled from your previous books of poems, but I was really surprised that you didn't have any representation from your very first book, The Story They Told Us of Light. And I wondered why that was.
I'd given up on that book. It had been a finalist in an Associated Writing Programs contest, and Elizabeth Bishop
had chosen it
with four or five other books, which AWP then represented. She didn't choose it as the winning book. But then it had just gotten lost, and I spent most of my, I guess, 20s. I think one of the poems in that book was written when I was 19, and I had experimented with a lot of things, including narcotics, but,
It was the time.
James Tate was a big influence on me, and I couldn't quite bring that into my own way of doing things, and I kept being mimetic in ways that I couldn't quite carry across on the page. A couple of years later, I was teaching at Virginia Intermont College, and I got a letter from, I think it was Malcolm McDowell, was his name, I believe, and he said, I've taken over the University of Alabama Press, and we've cleaned out the files, and we found this manuscript by you called Night Window. Could we consider it for publication? And I said, let me work on it a while. I was embarrassed by some of the work, the poems. I didn't think they were mature, but I asked some friends, and they said, revise it and send it to them. If it's bad, people will forget it. But see, you didn't. Not to say it's bad. There are a few poems that I wish hadn't been in there for other reasons that exposed people in ways that I wouldn't do now, that were inadequately fictional or outside the realm of what I would choose to publish. Alabama recently sent me a note saying, you'll be proud to know we're bringing the book back into print. And I thought, well, but I do like some of the poems. I don't know exactly why I didn't include those poems, but, you know, this was a hard book to put together.
I wondered about that. We had Ellen Bryant Voigt in here, and she was talking about her selected works, and she said when she started it, she thought it was going to be so easy. You know, she'd just go and pull poems and put them together, but she realized that she had spent so much time shaping the books themselves that the poems were in relation to other poems in the book, and she found it torture trying to pull these things.
I found it torture, too. When I put the selected poems together, originally I thought, I'm not going to acknowledge books. I'm just going to create a book putting the poems together in a new fashion, which I thought I could do because I'd been basically fairly honest at each point. I didn't know what I was doing, and I thought, my ignorances must be linked. These will fit together. But I did find it challenging to do that.
Yeah. Well, what made you then decide to divide them up by books?
I thought there were some differences between the way I approach things from book to book. And some friends said, people want a record that's connected.
I agree with that. As a reader, I enjoy that.
And I wanted to go from first to last. I didn't think I'd gotten better from 1984 to 2005. I didn't think I'd gotten worse. I thought I'd changed. I'd worked hard. There was some excitement, some lyrical moves in the first books I wouldn't have taken later. But the thing that disturbed me later was that I left some poems out that were better than some of the works that were here. I thought I could have put together another 100 poems that would be as good as this from the same period. That might be more interesting. I don't know.
Well, it's not too late. You could come out with a second volume.
I didn't like looking at it, though. The other thing is I kept looking for the great poem I'd written. You know, I thought, where's that one that I meant to write? It was the simple two-line poem that said everything.
That's why you keep writing, right? Because you haven't satisfied yourself yet.
The world hasn't been created yet.
No. Yeah. Well, you know, I thought I would have you read the opening poem in this book, Salvation Blues. We're traveling backwards from the point where the boy gets rescued. Did you actually have a fire when you were a child, or is this fiction?
Fiction, but I was thinking of several fires, and one that I had seen directly, but this is fiction, except for all the images.
Well, let's hear it and then talk about it.
Remembering fire. Almost as though the eggs run and leap back into their shells, and the shells seal behind them, and the willows call back their driftwood, and the oceans move predictably into deltas, into the hidden oubliettes in the sides of mountains, and all the emptied bottles are filled, and flake by flake the snow rises out of the coal piles, and the mothers cry out terribly as the children enter their bodies, and the freeway to Birmingham is peeled off the scar tissue of fields. The way it occurs to me, the last thing first, never as in life, the unexpected rush,
But this time I stand on the cold hill and watch fire ripen from the seedbed of ashes, from the maze of tortured glass, molten nails and hinges. The flames lift each plank into place, and the walls resume their high standing, the many walls, and the rafters float upward, the ceiling and roof, smoke ribbons into the wet cushions. And my father hurries back through the front door with a box of important papers, carrying as much as he can save, all of his deeds and policies, the clock, the few pieces of silver. He places me in the shape of my own body in the feather mattress, and I go down into the soft wings, the mute and impalpable country of sleep, holding all of this back, drifting toward the unborn.
Remembering Fire, from the collection The Unborn, and the title came out of the last line of that poem. The Unborn was published in 1985 and won the Lavin Younger Poets Prize, and it's the opening poem of the selected poetry of Rodney Jones called Salvation Blues. This is New Letters on the Air. I love the way it goes backwards.
Well, there were a couple of thoughts. It's interesting, the things in a metaphysical weighing of the world, all of the things are like triangles or cubes. They are geometric in their metaphorical possibilities, you know. So I think that's just a fact of phenomenology that we change for looking at the chevron on the curtain, that it changes in some way all of our perceptions. Merleau-Ponty wrote about that, and I believe it. And I think the things I was thinking about here that were very strange was the artificiality of the narrative, in that it happened in the past. We know the end. We remember the end first. And it's so odd that it's as easily constructible that way. And I remember always thinking as a kid, where did it begin? You know, where did my consciousness begin? And then I don't have any memory. It stops. And I always thought, that's death, too. The parentheses that Nabokov writes about, it didn't bother me at all to think of it that way.
Well, I thought this was an interesting way to begin a collection of poetry, because you're right, the artifice of the narrative is false. I mean, we already know how it's going to end, unless I guess you're the writer and you're spooling it out and you don't know which way it's going, but
I like different kinds of takes on that. My new book is in memory of two great writers that I love. Fiction writer Kent Harif, who is one of my best friends, and C.D. Wright, who became a friend very late.
We've lost both of them.
And that I miss terribly, you know, and who had a lot to do with the way I constructed the book that I'm working on now.
C.D. and Kent Harif?
Kent, I told him about the book, and he hoped to live to see it, but he didn't. And C.D. had written a response to another version of the manuscript that I'd sent her, and she liked it quite a bit, but she said, stroke of the key, hardly a thing. And I think I worked at least 7 months from what she said, accepting most of it as gospel, because it was just so obviously right. And I looked forward to sending her a revised manuscript, and just the week before I was going to send it, you know, she died.
She died. It shocked me because she was only, what, 67?
She was only 67, seemed in the prime of health. I guess Forrest Gander, the poet, her husband, had translated the lost poems of Pablo Neruda, and they had been in Chile for her birthday on January 6th. And there are pictures. She's having a great time, looks great. And I suppose sometimes when people fly, I don't know exactly what it is, the length of the trip, the immobility. It must be something else, too, that a clot develops, and that's what happened. I understand she died peaceably in her sleep, but she was really working at the height of her considerable powers, which I think she had been in since Deep Step Come Shining.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed her after that book came out.
In talking with C.D. about One Big Self, her book that she did with Deborah Luster about the prisons of Louisiana, in confronting how she wrote that book out of those interviews with people,
just selecting the interviews, I realized that there's not a template there, that she had to teach herself to write the book. And I talked to her about that, and I said, you don't know what you're doing. That's a great deal of your originality in that you have to figure out how to do everything. And the last letter I got from her, she was in California, and she said, I'm looking for something hairy. And I think that's the way she approached it. You know, she approached it as a legitimate body of information, for lack of a warmer word, that she was trying to put together. And she solved that problem. It required originality. It required her best mind, I think. I was bringing up she and Kent because Kent wrote in a very unusual way. His book, Plain Song, which I think is his best book, probably.
I love that book.
He wrote in scenes, and he put a stocking cap over his head, and he wrote it on yellow paper that he bought in a big sale somewhere and on an old manual typewriter. But he blindfolded himself. He didn't use any punctuation on his drafts. Tone was everything to him. He tried to get in the tone and wrote scene after scene after scene after scene about the same people and was able to piece this together into a book. But he said, I always know the end. So those are two very different kinds of ways of, I guess, looking, but both exploratory, imaginative.
Yeah, definitely.
No one can tell you how to do that work.
And they both brought out parts of the country that we don't see a whole lot. You know, C.D. Wright with Arkansas and Kent Hariff with the upper plains of Colorado. I got to interview him, too. So his work is very haunting.
His work is haunting, and his work is written with such an exacting ear. It's so odd that I would say the person that he learned most from was probably Cormac McCarthy. And there's Cormac just bent on proving naturalism. I love his language so much, you know, and yet there's so much aggressive violence and super figures who are mythological almost. But the language, Kent learned so much from studying his language, and there Kent is probably the sweetest spirited writer. I don't think he would be able to kill a character.
You might be right about that.
And yet, you know, people learn from each other, and how they may learn from each other without surrendering their power are their individual touches. That's magical.
It occurred to me just now, I'm going to skip over to your newer book, Imaginary Logic. You've got a poem in here called On Fiction. On Fiction has that reference to Kent Hariff and the way that he writes.
And to Rick Russo also.
Okay, I wondered who the other person
was. I should have said, Rick told me one time, he said, you know, and I think he meant this as a criticism, you know, there's always something Bolshevik in me. And he said, you know, to write about the country club, you got to go to the country club, which I agree with. But, well, I'm writing fiction now in poetry form and in prose, but I like the multiplicity of fiction. The woman who just won the Nobel Prize, who wrote about Chernobyl, the Russian woman, the journalist, I have been reading her, and there is no point of view that she has. She presents the point of view of other people. That's what I find magical, is the idea that point of view shouldn't be moral. That I think it's very dangerous, this idea that we cannot occupy or that we appropriate other people. I want to be able to be anyone in writing, unless myself at this point.
Right, right.
But this was more of a editorial on fiction.
I would love to have you read that.
To enjoy a story, I have to put myself in the protagonist's shoes, literally. As if for the instant of the telling, I've become the ideal podiatrist, and I expect real scenes, a stable at a hunt club or a quick mart by an overpass, and actual people with cowlicks or neck braces, even if they shortly will defy gravity or experience multiple orgasms of such proportions as to wipe out audits and biopsies.
I want, too, an account of useless virtues and eccentrics, perhaps a hermit amnesiac with an altruistic streak or a senator who knits. Tension goes without saying, a fact like temperament, politics, or humidity, which people die from every day but usually must avoid direct telling, else we have on our hands a prospectus, a dissertation, or treatise, not a story in any event. A story needs description and dialogue, those mutually parasitic engines of attention. Given language, the story tells itself. But take language back, you have the loneliness of the author, a quantity one must depart in the middle of the night and travel from tentatively by a series of unanticipated detours through a whiteout blizzard. One friend wore a stocking over his head, seated in his basement like a mad stock car driver with a yellow sheet rolling onto the platen. It had to be yellow. Of an old manual Underwood, sweating the generative sound, he left commas for later drafts. Another wrote at Denny's on a legal pad, white, not yellow. He liked having around him the companionable, irrelevant chatter. He wanted to live in the world, not out of it, and also to attain the feeling the extraordinary person most relishes, to know unexceptional people with names like Betty or Dot who still need stories and will tell them without saying a word. A few people, professors mainly, claim that the story has died, but most people, if they listen, know that in order for the story to die with any significant style, time must stop passing.
That's called On Fiction, and it's from Rodney Jones' book, Imaginary Logic. This poem felt very different. You like to experiment with style a lot in your poetry, which I really appreciate.
You know, when you don't have one, you've got to find it somewhere. Got to look for it.
You know, as I'm laughing here, I'm thinking, one of the things that I love about your poetry is your sense of humor. It comes through, and I find myself laughing out loud. And I don't know if it's being a fellow Southerner that I'm cued into that sensibility or if everyone feels that way about your work, but you'll have a turn of phrase that'll make me chuckle. I appreciate that.
Well, I'm glad, because I spend a lot of time attempting to make my life better by turning phrases. Some people have this purity of emotion. It's a very monochromatic and powerful emotion with an edge. And Eudora was not that way, or Flannery O'Connor was not that way. But there is some pressure, I think, to feel a certain way, a purer way, and I just feel them mixed. I hope people will laugh at my funeral after just bawling for a long time, you know. But
I'm going to have you go back to Salvation Blues, 100 Poems, 1985 to 2005. And speaking of chuckling, The Kitchen Gods.
Okay, I remember writing that poem.
And I guess this is from one of your early books. So
it's from Transparent Gestures, I believe.
Which won the National Book Critics Circle Award back in 1989 when it came out.
Right, that was a big surprise to me.
Because that's a big award.
It was a big award for a little feller, you know. So didn't quite know what to do with it. I remember getting to the ceremony and some woman said, "Well, who are you?" And I said, "My name's Rodney Jones." She said, "What do you write?" And I said, "Poetry." And she said, "How sad for you." And I thought, it was that kind of world. Okay, The Kitchen Gods. Carnage in the lot. Blood freckle the chopping block. The hen's death is timeless, frantic. Its numb skull lopped. One wing still drags the pointless circle of a broken clock. But the vein fades in my grandmother's arm on the axe. The old ways fade and do not come back. The sealed aspirin does not remember the willow. The supermarket does not remember the barnyard. The hounds of memory come leaping and yapping. One morning is too large to fit inside the mouth. My grandmother's life was a long time toiling between Blake's root and lightning Yahweh and the girlish Renaissance Christ that plugged the flue in her kitchen wall. Early her match flamed across the carcass. Her hand, fresh from the piano, plunged the void bowel and set the breadcrumb heart. The stove's eye reddened. The day's great spirit rose from pies and casseroles. That was the house. Re-roofed, re-tiled, modernized, and rented out. It will not glide up and lock among the stars. The tenants will not find the pantry fully stocked, or the brass boat where she kept the matches dry. I find her stone and rue our last useless, divisive arguments over the divinity of Christ. Only where the religion goes on without a God, and the sandwich is wolfed down without a blessing, I think of us bowing at the table there, the grand patriarch of the family holding forth in staunch prayer, and the potato pie I worshipped. The sweeter the pie, the shorter the prayer.
That was The Kitchen Gods. It is from the collection that won the National Book Critics Circle Award, Transparent Gestures, and it's included in Salvation Blues, 100 Poems, 1985 to 2005, by Rodney Jones, who won the Kingsley Tufts Prize for the selected poems. That was quite an honor, too. You've been honored throughout your life. How
nice. And not even my mother knows me. How did that happen, you know? That's a bad Alzheimer's joke. Oh,
that is bad. Is your mother still alive?
She is.
Does she have Alzheimer's then?
She does. I've been thinking a lot about memory in the book I'm writing now. It's a sort of a poetic novel that involves 50 years and six main characters who are prodigies from this imaginary community. But it starts with an Alzheimer's poem, and it talks some about brain chemistry as I understand it, which I don't understand all that well. But throughout the book, with various forms of dementia at some point, hallucinations at other parts, post-traumatic stress syndrome for one of the characters, just inventiveness and the effect of caricatures on our lives. And so I'm very interested in the fact of memory and the connections of times within one life. And it's all fictional, but that's the least fictional part of it. And trying to fictionalize that, or fictionalizing some of it and using some things, those are very tricky deals.
Is there a poem you'd like to end on? We only read one from Imaginary Logic. Is there something in there, or would you rather
I'll read a short one from Imaginary Logic, which not many words ended up getting down, but I like the spirit of the poem, I guess. This is called Hubris at Zunzal, and Zunzal is a beach in El Salvador.
That's where your wife is from.
Where my wife is from, yes. And for quite a few years, we would go there. Hubris at Zunzal. Nearly sunset and time on the water of 1984, language its tracer. No image like the image of language. I had waded out about thigh deep, then a shout from the beach. I held in my hand half a coconut shell of coconut milk and 150 proof rum, and dumped it white into the waves. When it came on me, how sweet it had been. Then the idea I was not finished. Then the act of reaching down with the idea I would get it back.
Hubris at Zunzal, from Imaginary Logic, by Rodney Jones, who also read from his 100 poems, Salvation Blues, while at Rockhurst University's 2016 Midwest Poet Series. His new novel of poetry and prose that he mentioned, Village Prodigies, is now out from Mariner Books. For links and information, follow us on Facebook and Twitter at New Letters Radio. Hundreds of writers, including his late friends C.D. Wright and Kent Hariff, or in the audio archives on our website, newletters.org. Produced at UMKC by New Letters Magazine, help on today's show came from Timothy Larrison, Danny Moran, Cassie Vaughn, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.